This is Vulnerability Matters from the Money Advice Trust.
Hello, hello. Welcome to a very special edition of Vulnerability Matters from the Money Advice Trust. I'm still Chris Fitch. Today's episode is an absolute exclusive, the first public conversation with Dr. Nicola Sharp Jeffs since she stepped down as CEO of the charity Surviving Economic Abuse and took her mission global. Without any hyperbole, Nicola has been the UK's leading voice on economic abuse in the last two decades. She conducted the UK's first research on the issue in 2008, created the widely used Economic Power and Control Wheel, and was instrumental in shaping the Domestic Abuse Act 2021, ensuring economic abuse was formally recognised in law. Now an expert advisor to the World Bank and co-founder of the International Alliance to End Economic Abuse, we caught up with Nicola in her UK home for an exclusive conversation that covered the rise of economic abuse in the public consciousness, the policy milestones and practical mountains she has encountered and overcome, and just how all essential services, not just financial, but those ranging from energy to gas to telecommunications, can act to both change and save victim survivors' lives. Nicola, welcome to Vulnerability Matters. Absolutely fantastic to have you here. Now, you're an international specialist in economic abuse. Yes, I am going to try and make you blush. You are. You're renowned. We're delighted to have you here. One of the things I've taken away from the many talks I've seen you give over the years is that while words and language really matter to you, that words and action together matter even more because they change lives. So with that in mind, can you explain what economic abuse means as a term, but also it means to you in terms of your journey on economic abuse?
Hi, Chris. Yes, thank you so much for having me. I guess put simply, economic abuse is the use of money and the things that money can buy as a form of power to control another person. But what we have learned over time is that that control generally takes three different forms. So the first, certainly, which I was most familiar with and which your listeners might be more familiar with, is restriction. So stopping someone from going to work, for example, preventing them from having a bank account or having to ask before they can spend money. And again, this results in dependency, which I think, again, is really associated with economic abuse. And certainly when I speak to victims and survivors, they talk more about different types of control. So one might be exploitation. So they're allowed to go to work, but their wages are taken by the abuser. Or it might be that the abuser takes out debt in their name, which they're then responsible for. And then this is the behaviour that I hear more and more. Just talking to a practitioner, straight researcher in Benin yesterday, they were talking about how communities were talking to women's increased economic empowerment, therefore leading to their partners refusing to contribute to household costs. So that would be things such as the rent or mortgage, food, utilities and childcare. So whilst that kind of traditional model that we might be more familiar with is different, so it's not the victim survivor being dependent on the abuser, actually the abuser's behaviour is creating economic instability. So that victim survivor might be earning lots of money, you know, even working multiple jobs, but they're not able to use that money in the way that they want to because of the behaviour of the other person. So that might mean they just end up with no disposable income at all. And it might even be that they're having to take out debt themselves in order to meet the household costs. And then the third form of control that we see is sabotage. So this might be causing someone to lose their job, for example. So we hear of victims and survivors saying that, you know, emails might be sent by their partner accusing their boss of having an affair with them, for example, which makes it, you know, very embarrassing to go into work. And so they choose not to. Or it might be the abuser, you know, destroying their laptop so they can't work, or taking their mobile phone away so they can't call work to say that they're not going in, you know, because perhaps they have a physical injury. And that kind of lack of communication leading to problems within the workplace, which would then cause them to lose their job. And as I've already alluded to, we see abusers destroying property a lot of the time that the victim then has to replace. So again, they're not spending their money in the way that they want to, and that creates that economic instability, which really shapes how they live their life.
But just unpack me a little bit about how economic abuse might be different from domestic abuse or financial abuse, just so we're all clear on that.
Yeah, so as you acknowledged, I guess, in your first question, I think language really matters. So if we're only talking about financial abuse, then we fail to recognise what I kind of call the true extent of abusers' actions. And by that, we don't then understand the lived reality of victims and survivors, or actually hold those abusers accountable for their actions. So economic abuse is different to financial abuse. Financial abuse is about the control of money and finances, whereas economic abuse is about the control of money and finances and everything that money can buy. So you're, you know, the very basic necessities that you need to survive. So access to food, clothing, shelter, heat, transportation, some of the tech that I've already mentioned, all of these things that we really can't function without. And that's why when we think about domestic abuse, actually, an academic called Evan Stark used to talk about it being a capture crime because it takes away people's freedom. It stops them from making the choices that they want to make. So if we're thinking about how that relates to domestic abuse, I would argue that financial abuse is a subset of economic abuse, and then economic abuse is a subset of domestic abuse. So it's a form of coercive and controlling behaviour which exists alongside other forms to create that lack of freedom for victims and survivors. So sometimes people think economic abuse is perhaps, you know, less serious than physical or sexual violence, but it has, you know, huge impacts on people's ability to live their lives.
Okay. Are there other terms or language related to economic abuse that we should bear in mind when we're thinking, talking and taking action on this?
Yes, I'm obsessed by language, actually. So I think it really matters how we talk about things and how we frame them, because it shapes how we're going to respond to them. So you might have noticed I always use the frame victim survivor, and that's because different framings are important for different people. So the word victim, certainly in the criminal justice system, confers certain rights to you, makes people feel seen and believed. But at the same time, a lot of people think that there's a lot of negative connotations associated with the word victim, and certainly, you know, that they might be weak in some way, that they're a victim to something. But again, we know that victims and survivors are so strong actually to be surviving the situation that they're in, that we want to be able to acknowledge that as well. So that's why I use both words together.
Let's think about the timeline. In 2008, news about the financial services sector was very much dominated by the global economic crash, rising unemployment and the financial impact on consumers. But very few people were talking, I think, about economic abuse as one of these impacts. So can you just talk us through the key events, the milestones, the turning points that have led to economic abuse emerging as what is now a recognised, if not major, issue for many financial services firms to tackle?
Yeah, so it's funny. So 2008 is actually when my journey started. So I was working for a domestic abuse charity and speaking to victims and survivors, as I've explained. And I recognised that they were experiencing economic abuse and immediately sort of turned to the research literature and looked for practice responses that responded to it, and very quickly realised that it wasn't actually recognised as a distinct form of domestic abuse, and it wasn't defined in policy at that time. So I think in terms of what changed, we have seen kind of two policy agendas emerge, relatively in tandem, I would say. So within the financial services space, and then also in the domestic abuse space. But certainly from about 2014 onwards, I've myself seen that financial services policy kind of started to talk about relationship breakdown as a driver of vulnerability, and at the same time, you know, the customer vulnerability agenda developing, which I think sort of really laid the foundations. Then in 2018, UK Finance published the Financial Abuse Code. So I think that was the first time we recognised that domestic abuse is distinct from relationship breakdown and brings it with it particular challenges. And then in 2021, the Financial Conduct Authority specifically recognised economic control as a form of domestic abuse within its guidance to firms on responding to vulnerable customers. And then in the domestic abuse space, the call for the financial abuse code that I've just mentioned actually came from the charity Refuge and the Cooperative Bank in 2015. And then several years later in 2017, the Prime Minister of the time, who was Theresa May, introduced new legislation on domestic abuse. And she actually proposed a statutory definition for the very first time. So up until then, within the domestic abuse space, we'd been using a policy definition that people could choose to follow or not, basically. And we wanted consistency, I guess in the same way that we wanted the consistency for customers in financial services, we wanted that same consistency for victims and survivors in contact with domestic abuse services. So a statutory definition was really important.
And we're talking about practical change, so let's stick with that here. Yeah. I was wondering, maybe using some examples from the people, the victim survivors, that you've had contact with and undertaken interviews and research with. I wonder if you could help us, Nicola, to think about some of the practical actions that people listening can take. So let's start with some basic ones and build from there. But what are the warning signs or red flags of economic abuse that frontline staff can be trained to recognise? And what should we do if we see one?
Well, certainly frontline staff in the financial services sector will potentially come across a lot of warning signs. So they might be having conversations with customers who have gaps in their knowledge about their finances, which might seem a bit odd, or they might say things that are contradictory, or they might indicate that they have got restricted access to their accounts. So that might be one warning sign. They might seem overly cautious. It might be that you get the impression that they appear to be taking instructions from someone who might be in the room with them, or they might appear sort of fearful or anxious, I guess, in their presentation as well. They might seem a bit inconsistent, so they might be describing financial hardship, for example, where actually, again, on paper, they have funds. You might be seeing a lot of money going into their bank account and not being able to sort of quite square the circle, I guess. And then there might be things like frequent changes to their contact details, for example, which might be suggesting that they're fleeing someone who's abusing them. So there might be things that they say, maybe references to arguments or conflicts about money with their partner that would give you the idea that something is happening. In terms of how you might respond, I mean, I think this can be a bit tricky, and I think it's why a lot of people don't respond. Because, first of all, you don't want to put someone into more danger. And it might be that the customer isn't alone, so you don't want to say anything that could increase that danger that they face. And you might not be aware that they could or couldn't be under surveillance by their partner as well, because we see a lot of tech abuse playing out in this space. So, you know, people being filmed, recorded and monitored in lots of different ways. But also a lot of victims and survivors don't recognise they're experiencing economic abuse themselves. So suddenly to, you know, announce to someone you think that might be their experience might be a bit, you know, a bit difficult both to say and for someone to hear. So certainly in that situation, I would always say, you know, to, you know, just kind of talk about the range of measures that your business might have to support vulnerable customers. So you might, you know, kind of list all of the things. Well, we provide support around gambling and mental health and domestic abuse. And if there was anything you ever needed support with, you know, we do provide support, and you might be able to find that on our website. So then the customer knows that support is available, and when they're ready or safe to take action, they can do so. And or if they suddenly recognise themselves that that's experience, you know, they might be able to think back to that conversation and recognise there's something that they can do. But if the customer does disclose, and again, we're hearing more and more of this, because one of the really powerful things about naming economic abuse is that we do give the language to victims and survivors to be able to explain what's happening to them. And that's really powerful. So if they do say, yes, this is my experience, then the advice is really based on what I call the three R's. So to recognise what the customer's told you, obviously in line with Texas, you know, to acknowledge and thank them for sharing that information. What's really important in the domestic abuse space is just to believe them. Don't ask them questions or try and verify if it's true or not. They'll have been told by the abuser that nobody will believe them. So the fact that you believe them, again, is hugely powerful. And then ask rather open-ended questions to try and understand how the business might be able to respond to that customer in terms of what it can do itself, but then also to recognise the need to refer to specialist domestic abuse charities and things like the Surviving Economic Abuse website, which has got lots of information in terms of how victims and survivors can access support.
So that's frontline staff. Thinking about product or service design changes, and the FCA certainly kind of put a lot of emphasis on design. Can you share some changes that maybe could be made at that design stage that financial services could really start to kind of address economic abuse?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot that those working in design can do to address economic abuse. And I'm the most positive person you'll probably meet, but I also know what abusers do and what lengths they go to. So I think as soon as we close down an opportunity to control, an abuser finds a different way of doing that. So I guess when I think about designing products, I start in a space which might just seem really simple, but I think is really important. And that's with firms actually stating in their terms and conditions that they don't condone the use of their products and services to perpetrate financial abuse, and to publicly publicise that they have done so, because I know that none of us really read the T's and C's. We found in countries across the world that actually doing that and just kind of naming the behaviour and letting abusers know that they're aware of it actually leads to reduced rates of financial abuse and the use of products and services. So I think just as a starting point, I would say that's really important. I'd also recommend focusing on designing out gender inequality that's been baked into products and systems. So I guess at the same time, therefore, also making sure that gender inequality and stereotypes aren't being designed inadvertently on that basis. So I guess I'm thinking of things like joint life insurance. So it's possible to insure somebody else's life in English law. It dates back to the 1800s when actually husbands insured the lives of their wives because their wives were their property. So I think, you know, really important that we're not designing our products and services kind of based on age-old sort of understandings and inequalities.
It's really fascinating how the detail is so important here. So things that can seem very dry and maybe even insignificant in their own right actually do have a huge kind of ripple effect into people's lives. It's absolutely fascinating. We've talked a lot about financial services and economic abuse, and that makes sense. But clearly there's multiple essential services in a person's life, so not just their bank or their financial service provider. So I was wondering, is there anything that energy, water, telecoms or other essential services need to be thinking about economic abuse as opposed to just financial services?
Yeah, absolutely. There's so many stakeholders that need to respond, because you can make those changes in one space, but you need that consistency to kind of really change those norms. So obviously they can put something about financial abuse in their T's and C's too, but also think about some of the good practice which is outlined in the FCA guidance. So that talks about the importance of specialist teams within customer vulnerability spaces. So customer vulnerability agents alongside specialist charities, for example. Also the best practice in the Financial Abuse Code, which is very much about safety. So really making sure that you integrate safe responses to victims and survivors. So that might mean redesigning and doing things differently in terms of your own practices as well. I certainly know that Ofcom guidance to energy companies on responding to financial abuse showcases something called the Economic Abuse Evidence Form. So the EAF, so that was developed by the charity Money Advice Plus and was piloted with Surviving Economic Abuse. And it encourages utility firms to sign up to that form, because not only do we see coerced debt, you know, happen in terms of, you know, credit cards, loans, mortgages, but it's equally applicable in terms of utility costs, and certainly with the cost of living and sky high costs now, just as another example of sabotage. Again, we see perpetrators deliberately running up the bills, and even post-separation can do this rather scaringly through tech-enabled abuse, where the victim survivor might not even be aware, but they've been able to rig up some kind of system, which means that they can, you know, plug appliances in, turn them on, put on heating, you know, manage lights, etc., from outside of the house, so can continue to do things that sabotage and increase the victim survivor's costs. As I said, really, you know, it's just so important that we have consistency in terms of all the different touch points that a victim survivor, you know, will be coming across in their daily life, really, so that, you know, our response is holistic and helps them.
Mm-hmm. Economic abuse won't affect everyone in the same way. So as we draw our conversation to a close, Nicola, just a couple more questions. One of these would be kind of, are there groups who face unique challenges within the economic abuse bracket, such as older adults, disabled people, or people from minority backgrounds?
Absolutely. And I was really impressed that the Financial Conduct Authority's review into vulnerability recognised intersectionality and recognised the additional challenges when you sort of layer them, I guess. So I've been talking a lot about different inequalities, obviously gender, but as you say, that might be age discrimination, discrimination based on race, discrimination because you might be disabled. So we see people who experience those multiple inequalities being more at risk of economic abuse, and that very much follows our understanding of domestic abuse more broadly. And that's fundamentally because people with multiple inequalities have less power, so therefore there is more opportunity for an abuser to take advantage of their situation. So if you're an older customer, for example, you might not be very au fait with internet banking and the way things are done. And so someone might, in a caring way, and this might be a situation with a family member, say, oh, you know, not to worry, don't worry, I'll look after you, you know, let me manage your finances for you, for example. A disabled person might not be able to go out to work necessarily. They might be getting benefits to support them, but the abuser might be taking those benefits away. The abuser might be doing things like not letting them charge their wheelchair, for example, not letting them use electricity. You know, the script might go, well, you don't go out to work, you don't contribute. I'm not going to, you know, let you use this electricity, which is very expensive for me to pay for, which could then, you know, create that unfreedom that I've been talking about. And similarly, you know, if you perhaps have English as a second language, you know, you might be struggling with the, you know, use of banking services and products. You might not understand the language. I struggle with the language, certainly. And you might not understand the systems and how things work in this country as well, which again, the abuser might take advantage of. So we can start to see that based on identities, and I guess just another really important message to communicate to listeners is that, you know, this behaviour is so deliberate that abusers tailor it to the situation that they're in. So while sometimes I think I might have heard everything, I'm sadly continue to be surprised about the lengths that abusers will go to control in this way.
If you had to leave listeners with one key message as we draw to a close about economic abuse, what would that message be?
It's one message in two parts. So I first, despite what I've just said about inequality, domestic abuse can happen to anybody and economic abuse can happen to anybody. So it doesn't matter how financially capable we are or how much knowledge we might have about economic abuse. It can still happen to those of us who work in that space. And secondly, that help is available.
Fantastic. Nicola, thank you very much.
And that was Dr. Nicola Sharp-Jeffs, bringing clarity, urgency and practicality to the issue of economic abuse. If you'd like to find out more about Nicola's current work, do visit allthingseconomicabuse, that's all one word, .com. But if you want to hear more from Nicola, we do have a special bonus edition coming up where Nicola walks us through her analysis of the strengths and the weaknesses of the recently published Financial Abuse Code. Essential listening, and this will be available next week, so do keep an ear out. So that's about it. So many thanks for joining us, and as ever, until next time, stay sharp, stay Jeffs, and remember that vulnerability matters. Vulnerability Matters was produced by Mandy McGreevy and Phil King and brought to you by the Money Advice Trust.